In the 30 years before 1997, real GDP in the Republic of Korea grew an average of 8.1% a year. By this measure, South Korea grew faster than almost every other developing country at the time. A powerful economic engine drove this growth, a delicate coordination between the government and its business elites. In 1997, that engine went out of balance and drove the country into a ditch. In this video, we look at how South Korea and its chaebol fell into an economic crisis. Just a reminder about the Asianometry Patreon, early access members get to see new videos first with selected references. Early access really helps a lot and appreciate every pledge. Thank you, and on with the show. The Chinese characters for chaebol literally mean financial clan or rich family. The word refers to a collection of diverse firms all owned by a single family. Most often, they begin with a single entrepreneur founding a business. Over time, the entrepreneur creates additional businesses around that first one, leaving his family members to run the remaining arms. Thusly, they all work with one another. Highly diversified business groups like the chaebol are not particularly unusual in emerging or recently developed economies. India, for example, has Tata Group, Reliance Industries, Adani, and Vedanta. In Taiwan, there are Evergreen Group, Fubon Group, Formosa Plastics, CTBC, Financial, Xinguang, Uniprecedent, and Houtai Group. In Mexico, which has grupos like Grupo Carso, Grupo ICA, FEMSA, and Grupo Alfa. Beyond that, diversified business groups can also be found in Thailand, Indonesia, Pakistan, and the People's Republic of China. There's clearly something about this structure that makes sense for emerging countries. The founding company finds that it needs something, but can't find it available in the nascent market environment, so they go ahead and start a brand new business to supply their own needs. The story of Lucky Gold Star, or LG, is a classic example of this dynamic. Their chairman, Ku Cha-kyung, recalled their founding story. "My father and I started a cosmetic cream factory in the late 1940s. At the time, no company could supply us with plastic cups of adequate quality for cream jars, so we had to start a plastics business. Plastic caps alone were not sufficient to run the plastic molding plant, so we added combs, toothbrushes, and soap boxes. This plastic business also led us to manufacture electric fan blades and telephone cases, which in turn led us to manufacture electrical and electronic products and telecommunications equipment. The plastics business also took us into oil refining, which needed a tanker shipping company. The oil refining company alone was paying an insurance premium amounting to more than half the total revenue of the largest insurance company in Korea. Thus, an insurance company was started. Chaebol also benefit from a trust element. In a market where you can't always trust who you're dealing with, where the rule of law is weak, the group's various businesses can trust each other because they are family. The diversification also helps with finances. In a country where the limiting factor is capital, not opportunity, the chaebol's arms lend money to one another and can bail each other out. Again, the family enforces the contracts and debts, making sure that everything holds together. And the group's various arms can help each other navigate what is often seen as a sprawling bureaucracy. In Korea, as late as the 1970s, you needed 120 documents to export a single product. So thusly, business conglomerate groups tend to perform quite well in emerging economy situations. But as the economy matures, those advantages become less relevant, and that can lead to problems. The South Korean economy grew a huge amount, but the ride was definitely not smooth. In the early 1970s, then-Korean President Park Chung-hee set up a military dictatorship and initiated a massive heavy industrial capacity drive. He had economic, political, and military aims. As I mentioned in a prior video, Park wanted to build up the country's military capacity and ensure his regime's stability in wake of an American withdrawal. Park also tied his legitimacy to his ability to deliver economic growth, at least at the beginning. Park motivated the chaebol to carry out his goals with cheap policy loans. Through its direct control of the banks, the government cut interest rates for favored industries to negative levels, adjusted for inflation. In this decade, Samsung first charged into semiconductors, Hyundai founded their now massive shipbuilding business, Daewoo got into shipbuilding too, as well as industrial machinery and construction. In 1976, 74% of all manufacturing investment went into heavy industry. Thanks to this heavy and chemical industrial drive, the economy boomed from 1976 to 1978. But the drive incentivized duplication and eventually overinvestment. The sector was left with unprofitable zombie firms. When oil prices soared again in 1978, it triggered inflation. The Korean government pulled back and restructured the overcapacity, compensating the banks for the loan losses. Then Park Chung-hee was assassinated in October 1979. In the political instability that followed, chaebol workers rioted for higher pay, and combined with a poor harvest, inflation climbed yet higher. And for the first time in 20 years, the Korean economy in 1980 contracted. In the chaos, the military general Chun Doo-hwan seized power. To lead his country out of the crisis, Chun made a Stanford-educated economist named Kim Jae-ik his economic czar. Kim recognized that the government's outsized influence in the economy had left chaebol unproductive and uncompetitive, so he organized a withdrawal. Kim retired over 8,000 civil servants and reduced subsidies to various sectors. This balanced the government budget. The deficit fell from 4.7% of GNP in 1981 to 1.4% in 1984. However, this liberalization also weakened the government's control over and coordination with the chaebol, setting them on the path to divorce after 20 years of close coordination. And sadly, the savvy Kim did not live to see through his reforms. He and several other high-level officials were killed in a 1983 assassination attempt on Chun Doo-hwan before a trip to Burma. Before the 1980s, the banks were nothing but a channel through which the government funneled money to companies. Bank managers had no autonomy in making or servicing loans. This power of the purse was how Park and the Korean government kept the chaebol in line. The chaebol's capital expansions left them heavily indebted from early on, 300 to 500% debt-to-equity ratios or more, and dependent on government largesse. For example, in August 1972, after Park Chung-hee seized power and people were rioting on the streets, he decided in a meeting with all the chaebol heads to order the banks to lower the interest rates. This saved the chaebol from bankruptcy, and the chairman supposedly cried with tears. This started to change in the 1980s. The government privatized the banks, and in 1982 began a slow liberalization of the country's interest rates. This was in part to suppress inflation, which came down from 28% in 1980 to just 7.2% in 1982. But liberalizing financial markets gave the chaebol new ways to finance themselves. Stocks, domestic bonds, foreign bonds, and most importantly, loans from non-bank financial institutions like insurance and securities companies. And in case you are wondering, like I was, securities companies were like brokerages that sold cash management services and lent money to businesses. By 1988, the top 30 chaebol owned 12 securities companies, 18 insurance companies, and 18 investment trust companies. Chaebol started funding themselves with loans from those entities, plus cash raised from selling foreign bonds. In 1980, 38.1% of the chaebol's money came from these non-bank sources. By 1988, that was 67.5%. It was still very much a dictatorship back then. In 1985, the combative and willful Chun Doo-hwan ordered the Korean banks to pull funding to the Kukje Group, a decently sized chaebol in Busan, supposedly because they had donated to opposition candidates. The heavily indebted company immediately collapsed and its parts sold to its cohorts. So there was still some iron in the glove, but things were changing. The kids are bigger now and can get their money elsewhere. They don't need to listen to dad so much anymore. Interestingly, South Korea's economy grew faster under Chun Doo-hwan than Park Chung-hee, more than doubling in size. We can point to the liberalizations for this, but also luck. In 1985, the Plaza Accord revalued the Japanese yen against the US dollar. The dollar fell in value, and with it, the Korean won. This sparked an unprecedented export boom in Korean semiconductors, ships, shoes, and sweaters to to the United States. Korean exports to the U.S. doubled from $10 billion in 1985 to $21 billion in 1988. Even so, Chun Doo-hwan lacked Park's legitimacy, charisma, or mojo, or maybe the people just had enough. In 1987, the Korean police waterboarded to death democracy advocate Park Jong-chul, triggering protests on the streets. Soon after, Chun Doo-hwan agreed to transition the country to democracy, and the government soon after held the first free elections, an epoch-making moment in time long awaited by a long-suffering people. Democracy brought new labor relations between the chaebol and their workers. Working patterns and attitudes in Korea had not much changed since the Japanese colonial period. In the 1970s, Korean workers worked longer than in any other country, including vast unpaid overtime. In 1978 alone, 1,397 Korean workers died on the job. 13,013 became totally or partially disabled. 137,845 suffered serious injury, and those are just the reported figures. As late as 1983, Korean workers still worked an average of 33.5 extra hours each month, unpaid. Business people at the time called it East Asian cultural values, or filial piety. I would call it a sweatshop. Park and Chun's dictatorships simply suppressed all the discontent with brutal force. Under democracy, unions rapidly grew in number, 19.5% growth in 1988 and 19.8% again in 1989. The factory workers took to the streets for better pay and working conditions. The strikes worked. The Korean workers' average wage rapidly grew over 50% between 1987 and 1989. They definitely deserve that money, but we also cannot deny that rising wages put pressure on the chaebol's profitability and cash levels. Democracy also released the chaebol as the government accelerated a policy and financial opening up. In prior decades, the government intervened in times of overcapacity in industries like machinery, textiles, coal mining, diesel engines, and whatever, coordinating different players to find a gentle way out of the situation. This eventually ended. In 1989, the chaebol, for the first time, openly refused a government order to reduce their investments in the petrochemical industry in the face of an impending oversupply situation. The overcapacity happened, and the Korean government had to impose export caps. In the early 1990s, Kim Yong-sam became Korea's first civilian president. He, encouraged by the chaebol, continued the liberalization and introduction of market influences. This largely translated to the chaebol getting whatever they wanted. For example, Samsung Group famously had wanted to enter the car industry, in part because Hyundai was competing with them and this was the way to compete back, and also because Samsung's chairman, Lee Kun-hee, liked fast cars. In 1995, Samsung finally got into the car business, despite it not being a good time to do so. Chairman Lee said at the time that he knew it would be hard, that they might not make money even after 5 to 6 years and $10 billion, but he felt it was strategic. Good for them. The problem is that the chaebol all wanted to be in these big, fancy, capital-intensive industries, like semiconductors, shipbuilding, petrochemicals, and cars. As one senior Samsung executive said, it was a macho thing. The business had been very profitable, but regulated. When it was deregulated, everyone wanted to jump in. Once you announce a project, you can't just back down, so we had to go ahead. In the early 1990s, the Kim Yong-sam administration conducted a broad and rapid campaign of financial deregulation. They deregulated interest rates, first rates on deposits and then in 1993 on all loans and corporate bonds, the idea being to improve the efficient flow of capital. They relaxed foreigner restrictions on stock purchases and bond issuance to encourage foreign direct investment. This triggered a flood of money into the country from abroad, Japan especially, where interest rates had recently been cut to 1%. Investors started borrowing Japanese yen and sending it to Korea in search of productive assets. And importantly, the chaebol were allowed to take more control over Korean banks and non-bank financial institutions. There existed 6 merchant banks before 1994. After 1994, 24 new merchant banks were created. These new banks were, to put it euphemistically, chaebol piggy banks. They were not as profitable as independent banks, and they were saddled with chaebol debt. So let us review our concoction. The chaebol had been piling up all this debt, much of which was denominated in foreign currency thanks to the boom in foreign capital. Worse yet, an increasing amount of that was short-term debt. In 1993, 43% of total debt had maturities of less than 1 year. 1996, 58.2%. Such short-term debt constantly needed replenishment, exposing companies to risk. Worse yet, the chaebol companies themselves were not particularly profitable, thanks to unproductive capital investments and rising labor wages. Most likely that, the chaebol had been functionally bankrupt for a long time coming. It just took something for it to all come up to the surface. The stage is now set. The crisis begins with a little bit of overcapacity. First, in 1995 and 1996, the Japanese yen depreciated, causing the won to strengthen, hitting the competitiveness of Korean exports, particularly their famed semiconductor memory chips. Notably, the price of 16-megabit DRAM fell from $50 at the end of 1995 to $9 by 1996, in part also due to a forthcoming transition to 64-megabit memory. The GDP growth rate fell from around 9% in 1994-1995 to 7.9% in 1996 and then 6.2% in early 1997. Still, great growth, you might say, and yes. But the chaebol had invested so much into building export capacity of steel, semiconductors, and petrochemicals. They were on the razor's edge, and now overcapacity was coming for these heavily indebted companies with weak cash flows. The first domino appears in late 1996, when the major steel conglomerate Hambo Steel starts to falter. The Hambo Group, the country's 14th largest, had been on thin ice for a while, after stupidly diving into real estate development and a titanic new steel mill. But people expected the government to do as it always done and save the company. No more. The Korean government lets them fall. Maybe they thought it can help the ongoing steel overcapacity problem. Maybe they lacked the policy tools to intervene. Maybe they felt it was just too large to save. Maybe it's Maybelline. On January 23, 1997, Hambo Steel shockingly declared bankruptcy with $6 billion of debt. Later, all the company's dirty laundry came out, including evidence of massive bribery and kickback corruption within Kim Yong-sam's administration and family. The myth of too big to fail now shattered, things move very quickly. The banks lending to Hambo are suddenly called into question, and since the debts of one firm in the group are guaranteed by its siblings, one crisis can easily spread. Credit ratings are downgraded, and now we are off to the races. Over the next year, 8 of the top 30 chaebol start to struggle. In March 1997, Sammy Steel goes bankrupt. Then in April, Jinro Group, Korea's 19th largest company and largest liquor maker, shows financial distress. They had an astonishing 40 times more debt than equity. Perhaps the managers got high on their own supply. 35 commercial banks unite together in a scramble to save the company and any other that might be in distress. The extra time does not help Jinro. They go bankrupt a few months later anyway. They're eventually bought out by another dominant liquor maker to create Haight Jinro. Still make soju, though. Meanwhile, in other parts of Asia, Thailand's real estate and bank crisis is fully underway. The Thai baht is forced to float and crashes, spreading financial contagion across the region. Back in Seoul in July 1997, the biggest whale of them all, Kia Automotive, South Korea's third-largest automaker and eighth-largest conglomerate overall. In 1996, they had 6 times of debt to equity. Some of the company's smaller component subsidiaries were in much worse shape. Has Kia struggled to find a way out, the government said that it was willing to let Kia go bankrupt. The public saw that as a ploy to let Samsung Motors, which had before tried to take over Kia, scoop up the company, a distasteful result. In the end, the government puts Kia into court receivership in October 1997, but they take a big share stake in the company via converting its loans to equity in an attempt to shore up foreign confidence. This did not work. If Kia can go, then who else? Foreign banks start calling in their debts, foreign investors dump their Korean assets, the stock market fell 2/3 of its value in 4 months, and they all start selling yuan. The Korean government tries to prop up the plunging yuan by spending $15 billion of its own foreign exchanges. This also fails. In November, the rate is 900 yuan to $1. By the end of December 1997, it is now 1,900 yuan, a rather noticeable change. That month, the Korean government sees no choice but to turn to the International Monetary Fund for a bailout. The IMF bailout remains controversial and continues to stoke great feelings of anti-Western sentiment. These games of politics and numbers on the screen filtered into the real economy. A new law passed in February 1998 allowed for layoffs and early retirement. The unemployment rate triples from 2% to 6.7% and then 8%. And the chaebol are forced to restructure, downsizing and selling their various unprofitable subsidiaries to meet their debt obligations. And this certainly helped make them stronger and more financially resilient. But critically, the government largely did not or could not force changes in how the chaebol made decisions, operated or reported. A missed golden chance. The chaebol drove South Korea into a ditch, and South Korea let them back out and keep on driving like as before. The consequences of that decision continue to this day. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.